Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Student loan debt in the U.S. had surpassed $1.6 trillion in March when federal lawmakers enacted a temporary freeze on loan payments as part of the pandemic stimulus package. The president extended the freeze until year's end, but the bills are still due. We're talking about the problem and proposed responses today. Michael Vasquez is a senior investigative reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Full payments on student loans restart January 1st. What's the likelihood that President Trump or Congress will intervene to extend it beyond that?
It feels very much like a coin flip to me at this point, which I think for borrowers means that you might not have to make payments come January, but you should budget for making payments in January, or at least explore your options for income-based repayment or some sort of delay on your payments because of unemployment or other issues that are qualifying reasons to delay payments. But you may have to pay in January. I think that's the assumption here.
And if the payment comes due in January, is that just you resume payments?
Exactly.
Okay.
But the tricky thing is that for borrowers, their financial circumstances may have changed dramatically in the last year, and payments that were once manageable may no longer be so.
And can they renegotiate those if that's the case?
There are a lot of options for borrowers in the sense that perhaps you may have borrowers who were on a standard repayment plan prior to the pandemic, and now maybe they're unemployed or underemployed, and there are options to defer your payments if you're unemployed. There are options to enroll in an income-based repayment plan, which, based upon your income, sometimes your payments are zero, and it counts as making a payment to the government, and even qualifies for loan forgiveness after 10 or 20 or 25 years, depending on your payment plan. But so you may be able to have your student loan payments be zero, but there would be some paperwork involved.
Right. You got to take care of business. Do we know how many people took the government up on the freeze that ceased making payments during this period?
I've heard numbers in the $35, $37 million range, but I don't have this precise number in front of me.
President-elect Biden could use the same executive power to provide broader and more permanent debt relief. What does he propose to do immediately?
There's a lot of chatter within the Democratic Party related to student loan forgiveness. And on the campaign trail, President-elect Biden talked about $10,000 worth of student loan debt forgiveness as a form of basically economic stimulus. And that is still on the table. There has also been some discussion from the Biden team about debt forgiveness, potentially more debt forgiveness, and tens of thousands of dollars of debt forgiveness for students who attended very kind of particular schools, for students who attended public universities or minority serving institutions, and only for undergraduate debt that is connected to tuition. And the reason for all of those caveats and limitations is if there is some debt forgiveness that happens in that way, the reason, sort of the logic of why that might happen in that way, is that one of the Biden team's proposals is to make public college tuition free going forward. This might be making community colleges free or tuition free, or however the pathway sort of shakes out. But that is something that the Biden administration is interested in pursuing. And let's say they get it done. Let's say, hypothetically speaking, that gets accomplished. Then you'll have public colleges being tuition-free going forward, but perhaps you might have a hue and cry from folks who attended a public college 5 years ago, and they say, well, I had to pay tuition for my degree.
Uh-huh.
And so that's why you would have this sort of looking backwards debt forgiveness that is specifically limited to tuition-related expenses at public colleges and universities.
And I'm trying to think about my experience and what other issues are there. There's fees, there's books, and other money and other things you borrow money for to pay for while you're in college, right?
Correct. And a lot of folks borrow just to pay the rent or to buy groceries.
Right.
And those things would not qualify for forgiveness.
So is there a sense that the people most affected by the pandemic, by any recessions we have, by everything in a negative way, disproportionately, are poor people and people of color, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the case with this as well, right?
That's correct. And that's why racial equity is going to be part of the discussion here.
Okay. How so?
There's, I think, political pressure and pressure in other ways as well, just sort of pressure from the public at large for the Biden administration to do something on the issues of racial equity. This is a country being torn apart by racial strife at the moment. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult, particularly if Republicans hold on to the Senate. It's very difficult for President-elect Biden to get much accomplished legislatively through Congress. But we do know when it comes to student debt that Black borrowers tend to borrow more and they tend to struggle more with repaying their loans. And there are a ton of societal factors that play into that in terms of just wealth accumulation, you know, generation to generation, and a whole host of factors. But at the end of the day, if President-elect Biden takes action on student loan forgiveness, that will help millions and millions of Americans, but it will particularly help Black Americans who were instrumental to his victory.
Would the forgiveness be dependent at all, or have they talked about a dependency of the forgiveness on whether or not somebody got the college degree? Because that's another disproportionately high number of people of color don't actually achieve the goal of the college degree and still owe all that money.
I have heard some chatter of income caps, and I think that could very much occur, where maybe it would be limited to borrowers who make less than $100,000 a year or $125,000 a year, wherever the cutoff might land. But there has not been discussion of excluding borrowers who did not finish their degree.
Okay.
And you are correct that the folks who don't graduate, the folks who maybe go to college for a year, year and a half, 2 years, and do not finish, they're the ones that often very much struggle to pay back their debts because they don't have a credential. They haven't really improved their job prospects significantly, but they have amassed this debt. And a lot of times, perhaps counterintuitively, the people who default on their student loans don't even owe that much. It's not, oftentimes it's not the folks who owe $100,000, it's the folks who owe $6,000 who are defaulting on their loans. And that's why, if let's say we land in a place where $10,000 of debt is forgiven for a lot of people as a form of economic stimulus, that will completely wipe clean the student debt of a lot of people. For a lot of folks, $10,000 in debt forgiveness means no more student debt, period. And that's life-changing.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're devoting this hour to the issue of student loan debt. As I said at the outset, it's around, I keep blocking it out, $1.6 trillion. That was last spring when Congress enacted a temporary freeze on loan payments as part of the pandemic stimulus package. The president extended the freeze until year's end. What happens after that is, as my guest Michael Vasquez of the Chronicle of Higher Education just said, something of a coin flip. So coming up in the program, we're going to have economists on that study these issues. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So what about the authority of the Department of Education, Michael? Can it intervene in any way?
The Department of Education has a lot of authority. One of the things that makes some form of student debt relief more likely is that it's something that the president and his administration and education department officials, they can do a lot on their own. And because of that, and because there is this clamoring for student debt relief within particularly the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, there are folks who are going to expect Joe Biden and his education department to do something because they can, regardless of whether Congress is interested or not. And there are some legal caveats in terms of, let's say, doing things through executive action. There probably will be legal challenges, but at this point, I have not heard anything that would make that. It seems to be, from the talk I've heard, that it's probably legally defensible for the president and his education department to do things on student debt. And part of that could be through executive action and just immediately forgiving debt. But also when it comes to the education department, there's a huge role that the education department has in determining whether students were ripped off and whether their debts should be forgiven just because they were taken for a ride and they were enrolled at a predatory college that did not really give them much of an education at all. And during the Trump administration, we saw former education, or I guess she's still technically education secretary at Betsy DeVos, we saw her take a very hard line on the issue of debt forgiveness for defrauded students. And so you had this tremendous backlog of, I believe, hundreds of thousands of borrowers who had applied for debt relief, saying, listen, I enrolled at this college. They made a bunch of lofty promises, and it turned out to be a lie. And I need help. Like, I'm really struggling
and,
here.
And by the way, I just want to clarify, sure. And this was using federal funds. These are federal loan
these
debts.
Are federal loans. And the fundamental problem is that a lot of colleges, a lot of students, initially, they give colleges the benefit of the doubt. They don't think that a college is out to get them or out to deceive them. But when they sit down with recruiters at a lot of institutions, unfortunately, you're sitting down with basically like a used car salesman. And imagine if you walked into a used car lot and you thought that the salesman was your friend and was really looking out for you. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens to students. They enroll at colleges that are just completely unethical sometimes. Those colleges do exist. And the problem in terms of the problem and also the responsibility of the federal government is because the federal government is so loosey-goosey when it comes to giving out federal loans and federal Pell Grants to colleges, there are very few quality standards, or accrediting standards are often a joke. And so you have students who maybe enroll at a questionable college, but part of the reason why they make that extraordinarily fateful decision is because the government has approved these folks. You know, that they look and they say, well, this college is eligible for federal student loans. They're eligible for Pell Grants. They're approved to participate in this federal program. They can't, you know, they must be legit. And that's not true. It's just that the federal government has been asleep on the job in terms of policing these institutions.
I thought they were going to get better at that.
They were
Seems like I did a show about that a few years ago.
There were some modest improvements during the Obama administration, but it's a difficult... The challenge is twofold. There's a tremendous amount of political pushback that occurs when powerful folks in Washington, when the government in Washington tries to go after the for-profit college industry. I can recall reading about scandals that the Boston Globe investigative team, the spotlight team at the Boston Globe, they did a whole series on for-profit college abuses in the 1970s. And I remember seeing some of those stories, and some of those schools that were exposed by those investigations in the 1970s were still in business 5 or 6 years ago when I was looking back at those old stories. And so there's that part of it that, unfortunately, in a staring contest between the industry and our government usually blinks. But beyond that, there's the problem that the fraudulent practices are sometimes so prevalent within certain colleges. I've had conversations, I remember, with an employee at one college that was later found to be engaging in all types of fraud. And I remember talking to an employee at that college, and we were talking about these like student satisfaction surveys, because sometimes colleges will say, well, we can't be a scam college because 98% of our students are satisfied. And then I was talking to this employee, and she mentioned to me just very casually, very much in passing, she's like, oh, yeah, like we as the employees, like we fill out those student surveys. Like we pretend we're students and we just pick a day and we get all into a room together and we just forge a bunch of documents and we just pretend we're students and they were all satisfied.
There's another thing. Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry. No, again.
There's another thing, too, is I remember learning about how the for-profit colleges and for-profit. We mean these are like usually kind of trade type of schools.
Yes, that's correct.
Nurses, you know, whatever it might be, some kind of technical school. Anyways, that they would actually kind of sell them the students on the school and help them get the federal loans.
Oh, yes. There have been instances. And this particularly is relevant during the pandemic because there have been some indications that some for-profit colleges, at least, are doing really well right now. As the economy is completely in a tailspin and folks are really struggling everywhere, the for-profit college industry is doing kind of okay right now. And part of the reason why they excel is they make everything so easy.
Yeah.
Where you walk in and they take care of the paperwork for you. They will fill out your financial aid paperwork for you. And there have been instances in the past, actually like sometimes documented with undercover cameras and sort of thing, where for-profit colleges will have encouraged students to lie about their finances on federal forms, which is a crime, because they want to maximize the amount of federal loans and Pell Grants that they can get out of you. And so if you own a house or you have certain assets that they know will reduce the amount of money that Uncle Sam will give you, there have been instances where they've told students, "Yeah, don't put your house there. Don't put those assets down. Don't worry about it." And students don't know any better. Students are not experts in federal financial aid
law. Especially the most vulnerable, the people.
Exactly.
You know, there's this. They're not going after young people whose parents have a lawyer to go over the forms with them. They're going after people who don't have other resources, who don't have other kinds of people to go. Let me ask you one other thing, Michael, before I have to let you go, and that is federal forms of debt versus private forms of debt. All of this debt forgiveness that we're talking, or proposed debt forgiveness that we're talking about, all of the debt freezing that went on, that was congressionally approved and then extended by the president through executive order, all of this stuff that we're talking about, that has no bearing on private debt.
Generally speaking, yes.
Okay.
All of the power that the federal government has to help you, the borrower, typically deals with federal debt because they control that debt. It's hard for them to tell Discover or some other entity that has your private loan to treat you nicer. But interestingly, with the HEROES Act that was approved by the Democratic House of Representatives, there were some provisions in there for debt relief, and I believe the final language that ended up being approved by that bill, because there were multiple versions of the bill, the final language of that bill actually did outline some federal loan forgiveness for private loans.
Were the federal government paid them off?
I'm not sure of the particulars, and it was one of those bills that it was really just a political statement type bill. The House passed it. They knew the Senate was not going to do anything with it. But what that tells me, the fact that some language dealing with private student loans ended up in the bill, is that there's some lobbyist or some group of folks somewhere on Capitol Hill that would like that language in there. And that the fact that it ended up in there once in a bill means it's at least within the realm of possibility if you have private loans that maybe you get some help, but I wouldn't expect it.
Yeah. And then that $1.6 trillion with a T dollars that we're talking about in student loan debt in the U.S., is that just the federal student loan debt, or is that the estimate of all of it?
All of it, but it's overwhelmingly federal. Maybe there's a couple hundred billion in there of private, which I say it like it's nothing. Yeah, just a couple hundred billion.
I know.
There's
a couple hundred billion in private debt. Crazy. It's crazy.
Overwhelmingly, it's Uncle Sam's debt.
Okay. Well, Michael Vasquez, I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
You got it. Take care.
Michael Vasquez is a senior investigative reporter from the Chronicle of Higher Education. We're going to talk to some economists going up. We're going to hear some pros and cons about all of this. If you have a question, comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Just to remind you, we're talking about student loan debt in the U.S. It surpassed $1.6 trillion in March, back when federal lawmakers enacted a temporary freeze on loan payments as part of the pandemic stimulus package. That freeze at this point expires at year's end. So we'll see what's up. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the issue of student loan debt in the U.S. It totaled more than $1.6 trillion last spring, most of that federal student loan debt. A loan payment freeze on that debt expires at the end of December. But not all student debt falls under federal control, as I said. Much of it, or some of it, is private. Some is issued under the purview of the states. Rachel Collier is a program director for the Ohio Student Association. That's a group that lobbies for universal access without debt to higher education. Welcome to the show, Rachel.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And Pete Van Leer is a research consultant for Policy Matters Ohio. It's a liberal-leaning think tank. Welcome back, Pete.
Good morning, Ann. Thanks for having me, too.
Pete, so how does it stack up in Ohio? How much debt do Ohio students have?
So some of the numbers we have from the Student Borrower Protection Center, we have 1.7 million student borrowers in Ohio with about $63 billion outstanding debt. And about more than 300,000 are in delinquency, owing about $8 billion. So, and the average debt in Ohio for Ohio borrowers is just over $36,000. So that's a quick snapshot, a lot of numbers, but.
Yeah. And as far as Ohio's ranking on that score, middle of the road,
Yeah, I don't know exactly. I can't give you that number exactly, but it's, you know, you can, you get a pretty good picture. It's a, it's, there's a lot of, especially the delinquency numbers, and it really impacts, as your previous caller said, you know, the lower income and borrowers of color are particularly impacted by it.
And what's the impact on the state and the state economy, the state at large, when that much debt is pending among the relatively young and already relatively low income, and when that much is also delinquent?
Yeah, well, you can imagine if you've got people owing an average of $36,000, that's money that they're, you know, every payment they make is money they can't spend elsewhere in the economy. It holds them back from maybe purchasing a car or getting buying a home. You know, it, other purchases are put on hold because of this kind of debt.
And Rachel, low income and people of color are disproportionately affected by student loan debt, as Pete said. Can you explain the implications of that?
Yeah, so we know, first of all, that white families, for example, have up to 7 times more wealth, than Black families. And so we end up with a situation where there's this, maintaining the class structure, it doesn't allow for mobility, and it recreates the same inequalities that we've seen for hundreds of years, where you see women, marginalized people being forced to take on these higher student loan balances, being preyed upon by these for-profit colleges and struggling to repay the loans, especially due to lower graduation rates and wage gaps. So it continues to just reproduce these same inequalities and same struggles when really what higher education should be doing is creating a level playing field.
And I'd like both of you to respond to what I know is a question out there, and it's the same one that people had when the predatory lending practices were exposed regarding home mortgages. They wonder, well, whose fault is that? Is it the borrower or the lender? P. Van Leer, can you talk about the predatory practices and how they play a role in this, and kind of connect the dots for people about why this is an issue they should care about when they're paying their loans off?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good question. And Mr. Vasquez, from you had on before, talked about it too. I mean, it really is a structural problem. It's like how these industries are set up. You know, there's the student loan system that we have now started as very small back in the 50s. It was about just sort of supplementing. And that's become this wholly other thing where, you know, to go for so many people to go, they have to go in debt. They get trapped in debt. The for-profit piece is very true in Ohio. These schools in Ohio are, you know, these for-profit schools are more expensive, and they really don't prepare people well to move on up into the job market and get better paying jobs. So it's really not an individual thing. It may feel like it. Well, why did that person fall into that? Why did they sign that loan? Whether it's a mortgage loan or medical debt or student loans, it's all part of the same sort of system, which was created to help people get their education. And what it's doing really is trapping more and more people. And as the previous caller said, you know, the for-profit industry is just geared toward getting people the loans that will enrich them, these more expensive for-profit schools, at the expense of the students themselves, who then end up with more debt. So it really is not an individual thing. It's a systemic thing that affects everyone in different ways.
Yeah, and Rachel Collier, anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, I would just say, like, so much of this, too, you think about, I mean, oftentimes you think about just tuition as the cost of getting an education, but actually we have some members who are participating in our efforts for advocacy around this who had to take out loans just to cover the cost of housing. And many universities now require freshmen to live on campus and take on that additional cost. It's a, you know, extremely high cost. My sister is actually a freshman at Ohio State University. All of her classes are online, but yet she's still forced to pay for to live in the dorms and live on campus. So there's so many costs that students are just taking on here. And there's so little education about it, too. If your parents didn't go to school, you may not have, you know, the support to actually figure out, okay, what loans should I be taking? Mm-hmm. How do I navigate this process?
We have an email from Chris from Galena, who says, I think that it addresses or gets into this a little bit, Rachel. Chris or he or she writes, we don't have a debt problem. We have a cost and choice problem. During the 2019-2020 academic year, the average cost of attending college was $30,017 per year. According to the American Association of Community Colleges, the average cost of attending a community college for 1 year is $3,347. Students make naive, uninformed decisions about where to go to college, and then when they get the bill, they understandably suffer from sticker shock. Every student should begin college at a community college or a regional, and the student loan issue is hugely alleviated. Rachel Collier, what do you think?
Well, I'd say that there's a number of complicating factors there. I mean, first of all, there's not necessarily special. Some people are looking for different to study different things where there is a specialty in a certain place. You get a lot of messaging around like, oh, well, this is where you should go or this is where you shouldn't go. Also, community college may not even necessarily be affordable for many people. There are states that actually do have free community college for students. And, I would agree with this person that community colleges are an important resource and should be better funded as well to make sure that education is accessible for everyone. But there is no reason that other schools should be as expensive as they are. Even state schools. I personally attended The Ohio State University, and that it is extraordinarily expensive to attend, even if you do live in state. So even the schools that are, state schools or community colleges can still be cost prohibitive for many people.
Pete Van Leer, there's the cost issue, and Rachel's raised some of those issues too. The rate of I don't have anything to back this up, but it seems to me there's got to be a correlation between the rate of debt in this country and the cost of college. I mean, back when I 100 years ago when I went to a state school, I think it was like $25 a credit hour. It's insane how expensive it is now.
Yeah, and I think this is something that comes down that can be done at the state level. I mean, we're talking about some federal issues, but at the state level, funding for the state share of instruction, which is the main way that the state funds public colleges, community colleges, and universities, has really stayed flat or gone down when you adjust for inflation over the past 15 years. So it's not keeping up with the costs, and so that really impacts people who can't afford it or who have to borrow more to afford it. So this is definitely connected. And also the way they structure financial aid, the need-based aid in Ohio, the state support for that has also dropped. But it's also structured in a way that it really is out of reach for many, for students who want to attend community colleges or some of the lower cost four-year universities in Ohio. It's just the lower cost schools, they can't access that money because of the way it's structured. So it's a last dollar fund. So if you get a Pell Grant and you're paying for community college, you can't get the state grant because it's not expensive enough, right? So if they were to make that grant a first dollar, they could use it for the different expenses. All these monies would help students attend the lower cost colleges that really could serve them well if they were able to access them without having to pay as much out of pocket or take on as much debt.
Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And John in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, John.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is that I agree that, some loans are predatory loans and what have you and whatnot, but what are we teaching these young people if we pay off their loans? I mean, they're just going to go on to the next thing and buy a house they can't afford I don't think we're teaching them well be paying off.
Yeah, Rachel Collier?
So a couple of responses to that. I mean, first of all, the cost of going to college has risen drastically, and the amount of burden that student debt represents has increased so drastically. I mean, it was very different when my parents went to school. You could work a summer job and potentially cover your tuition, and that's just not possible. So it's a shifting expectation that we're placing on young people. I mean, I can say for myself personally that my partner and I would buy a house if there was no debt, right? And it's not that we're irresponsible and we would like to be able to purchase a home. And many young people find themselves in this position. For many people of my generation, we would like to be able to put money back into the economy to be able to buy homes.
Well, it would be a wealth building thing if you buy a home.
Exactly.
With student loan debt, it's just debt.
Yep. And it's just sitting there. And so many people that I know have this debt and they pay every month. My cousin actually has more debt now than when she started, even though she hasn't she has continued to pay consistently. The way that the interest functions on this, even if you're paying as much as you can per month, you know, you may even pay the full cost of your original debt and still have more debt than what you started with, because you simply can't, you know, the interest is so high that you can't pay it down.
And Pete Van Leer?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. I think this is always a question that comes up, and it goes back to, like, this is a system that's set up in a certain way. If we think about what is the purpose of our current student loan system, we'd like to think it's to help more people get an education. But what it ends up being is really, it traps people in debt, and it's a way for the debt industry to thrive, right? Loan servicers, debt collectors are making a killing on this. And that's not how we should be structuring our society. We should be thinking of education as a way for people to improve their lives and to reach their educational goals and dreams, and then, you know, get better paying jobs and contribute to society. So we think about it as, oh, so-and-so, so an individual makes a mistake and they should learn from this mistake and we need to punish them. I would say that's just really the wrong way to think about it. We need to think about it as what's good for our society, for Ohio's economy, for our communities. What would be best for them would be to get more people debt-free, educated, and able to participate fully in our communities and our state economy.
John, thanks for that call. Pete, institutional student debt is debt owed to colleges and universities directly, as opposed to the federal government or another student loan provider. Do we know how much of a factor that is in this larger equation?
Well, I mean, it's definitely a piece of the same problem. You know, the way debt is institutional debt, you know, money for tuition and fees and what have you owed directly to public colleges and universities in Ohio, you know, that's sent to the Attorney General's office. You know, $730 some million in debt right now, and that's being collected on. And again, it's another part of this whole, you know, who makes money off it is the debt collectors. And the students who are stuck and trapped, and their families often are trapped in this cycle, and this they can't move on because they owe this money, even when they try to pay it off. And they could access other funds to continue their education, but they're often trapped by this. Their transcripts are withheld. So it's definitely another piece of this whole approach that we have to education, rather than helping people, thinking about how to move them forward and help them move forward, we consistently hold them back, and we hold ourselves back as a society, as a state.
I have two emails from people regarding the Parent PLUS loans. One asks whether if you can address them and any assistance or possible forgiveness. A COVID job loss, Michael writes, will make it nearly impossible for us to keep up with a six-figure debt once forbearance ends. And then Diane wrote, she says, I still got a Parents PLUS loan for dependent undergraduate students acquired under the FFEL program, whatever that is, prior to the beginning of the direct loan program in 2007. Wow. Are there any considerations for this type of loan qualifying for forgiveness under the economic stimulus program that is being developed? P. Van Leer, do you know about the Parents PLUS loans and how they fit into this?
I am familiar with it. I don't know where it falls in terms of potential for debt forgiveness, but it really should be part of that package. I mean, we've heard, you know, there are some Parent PLUS loan stories we've heard in Ohio around the institutional debt piece, where uh-huh. parents took on debt to support their children, and now they are also stuck, and repayment plans are really not reasonable, and it's just a really hard system to navigate. So I think, you know, it should be part of this same conversation of how we help families who are stuck in this. And so it's definitely a concern that we have, and that state policymakers and federal should be paying attention to.
Rachel Collier, I've got to let you go, but I thank you so much for your time. This is obviously an ongoing topic, and hopefully we can call on you again.
Certainly. Thank you so much.
Rachel Collier is the program director for the Ohio Student Association. That's a group that lobbies for universal access to higher education without debt. Pete Van Leer is going to stay with us. He's a research consultant for Policy Matters Ohio, a liberal-leaning think tank. And joining us will be a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, a conservative-leaning think tank. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The federal government's a big player in the student loan market, and as such, it has a lot of power. Progressives want to see that power used to forgive some or all student loan debt for millions of people. Others argue that such forgiveness should be reserved for those struggling the most to pay. Pete Van Leer is a research consultant for Policy Matters Ohio, a liberal-leaning think tank. He stays with us. Allison Schrager is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, a conservative think tank. Allison, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So where do you fall on the issue of student debt? Is it a forgiveness thing? Is it how much forgiveness? Is it a free, you know, what's the equation you look at when you consider this $1.6 trillion problem?
Well, I think when it comes to any entitlement, which this would be, is you have to think about, you know, we have limited resources and who is most in need. And generally, college graduates earn so much more than everyone else. It's unclear to me why they would be the ones first in line for a bailout.
Why do you say first in line? I mean, is that what you're seeing this as?
Yes. I mean, we're not talking about bailing out people's mortgages. We're not talking about bailing out car loans. Thing is, when you take money out to get a degree, assuming you finish, there is a population of people who don't finish their degree.
Right.
And they tend to be really overwhelmed by their student debt because it didn't increase their earnings.
Right.
But if you do finish your degree and you go to a reasonable school, then what it does is it increases your earnings over your lifetime, not just in your 20s, but it means you have this asset that pays off over your lifetime. But like you think about a car loan, the second you drive a car off a lot, it decreases in value. And honestly, low-income people are more likely to have car loans than student debt.
There's also the question, though, of how it's one thing to take out some debt when I did a long time ago, back when tuition mm-hmm. was very reasonable and I didn't appreciate it very much at the time. And mm-hmm. now when to even go to a state school, it's $30,000-$40,000 a year.
Yeah. And I mean, that's due to a lot of factors. Not the least of it is that we subsidize student debt. So people have become less price sensitive and universities have responded by increasing tuition. But you also have to appreciate that the value of having a degree in the labor market has also increased. So even if you do take out this much debt, and anyway, it's a lot more than it was before, odds are it will pay off.
Many people who support canceling student debt say that it would stimulate the economy, that people would go out and spend that money on other things that that would create jobs and generate wealth. I mean, there's the multiplier effect that would have come into play.
Well, even left-wing economist Jason Furman disagrees with that, because generally, if the multiplier effect happens if you target people who have what we call a higher marginal propensity to consume, meaning like they don't have a lot of money right now, so if you give them, they'll spend more.
Yeah.
But I think college graduates tend to have higher incomes. So between that and the possible tax liability that happens from debt forgiveness, it's not clear that would really stimulate their spending. And in fact, your earlier guest brought up that you can't buy a house. In fact, if you look at the data, homeownership is up amongst young college graduates. It's only down among people who didn't go to college at all, because they are increasingly more squeezed out of the labor market and have less income and can't afford homes. So it's not really college graduates, or even there's even a high correlation with having high college debt and being a homeowner.
So then let me ask you, Allison Schrager, do you see any problem right now with the $1.6 trillion debt that was posted in March?
Absolutely. I mean, there are people, again, mainly people who didn't finish their degrees
right.
or went for a for-profit school, that are struggling. They don't see that increase in earnings. They have this debt for a degree that really didn't finish or brought them nothing. But I said there are one programs to help them, which certainly could be reformed, mainly programs that base your income payments, your debt payments based on your income. Or my colleague at the Manhattan Institute, Beth Akers, has suggested a loan forgiveness up to $5,000, because those people tend to have smaller amounts of debt, but they're still overwhelming them. Bringing it up to $50,000, say, which is one of the proposals right now, would really be a massive bailout to people who are like doctors and MBAs. They're the ones who have the big debt amounts. But the smaller debt amount holders tends to be the people who are struggling the most.
Okay. And that's a point you made earlier, Pete Van Leer.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think we could argue back and forth about what the right amount is. I would take some issue with some of the numbers I've seen from from the Manhattan Institute on this in terms of income levels. But I think the fact is that there's a growing consensus that the way we, funding higher education through individual debt is really not sustainable. And I think we need to start looking at, some combination of debt forgiveness, whatever the amounts might be, income-based repayment, and just really better funding higher education so that it's more accessible to more people. Because we are really, a combination of these factors is holding people back in Ohio and around the country. Everybody knows at this point that the better paying jobs, if you want to get a living wage job these days, you've got to have some level of post-secondary education, mm-hmm. whether it's certificates or credentials of value in the workforce or associate's degree, a bachelor's degree, whatever it might be. Higher education is increasingly important, and everything we're doing, and student loans is a big part of the problem here, are really just holding people back and holding us back in general.
Let's see, Jason in Delaware, you're on the air. Hi, Jason.
Good morning, everyone. How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
I wanted to tell you about my story. I graduated from a small school. I made the right financial decision. Only left school with my bachelor's and $36,000 in debt. That was 9 years ago. I've been paying $300 a month on the payment. And in that time, so that's roughly $32,000 that I've paid. Well, my balance is still $24,000. I think a problem with a lot of this is the way they structure these student loans, you never escape the payment. You have to make a big payment at once to pay it off. Or if you keep making the monthly payment, it's not like a mortgage or a loan or anything like that. You are stuck with that payment for an extraordinary amount of time, and they just structure it so that you continue paying and paying and paying.
Was this a federal? Was this a federal loan?
Yeah, it's all through the Fed. I go through my Fed loan every day or every month to make my payment. Even during the pandemic, I'm still making my payment.
Okay. All right. So, Allison Schrager, when he's talking about how these are structured, do you see any room for improvement on that score?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly could make it easier to refinance, certainly because interest rates are so low right now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it sounds like he's been paying, a very high interest payment if he still has that much debt after all these years and paying off so much. So, as I said, and also, as you pointed out, some of these loans are subsidized by the government and they're federal loans. They have lower interest rates. Sometimes you also have to take out private loans that have much higher interest rates. So I think we need more education on this and certainly better options and more awareness about restructuring options.
Jason, good luck with that. Thanks for the call. Martha in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Martha.
Hi. I find this just fascinating. I'm a teacher in the area and I teach high school. And I would like to just throw out there that one of the things that's a problem at the urban school that I teach in is that college. Their kids are told that's the only way they can really find dignity. Careers are a part of the equation, but I would just like to say that I think so many of my kids would be in much better condition and able to earn a living wage if they, first of all, didn't do that first year of college where they realize it's not what they want to do. They've accrued a whole lot of debt, and then they don't know how to get out of it. And I think this starts in high school, and I think that we as teachers and as a country can do a whole lot better by our young people by not telling every single student that they the only way they can be successful is to go to college.
Right. And, P. Van Leer, that kind of goes to what you were saying, that, the statistics show that people who have a college degree tend to earn more. But, there are a lot of questions now about the value of a college degree and whether maybe students have been cut and torn away from other opportunities, other options, the trades, apprenticeships and that kind of a thing. And is this a root problem that we need to address as well?
I think we need to understand that, a four-year college degree might not be needed for everybody, but there is, what we need is post-secondary education and training more increasingly is needed. And that can look different for different people. And I think we have to acknowledge, the different needs and the different approaches and support all of that. And I think all the callers, we've all talked about the for-profit piece and how that's just preying on people like who might just need some kind of certificate or some training after high school. And that leads them astray. And the money that even those kind of programs, as we know, are ending up, you know, costing them more money than they can pay off, and they don't have the value of a degree. So I think regulation of that for-profit industry is really important. I think we really need to think about, I was thinking about Jason who called before. I mean, we hear these stories all the time. It's clearly an issue, but it's not an individual issue, and we can't put it back on the individual saying, oh, they made a mistake or they have the wrong kind of loan. It's a systemic issue, and we need to deal with it with policy both at the state and federal level that stops putting, you know, making at the student loan system the way we fund people's higher education. We need to really rethink how we do this. And it's not an individual problem where we can say, oh, somebody just made a bad choice. It's about the choices that are out there being, many of them being bad choices, poorly regulated. And I think the student loan forgiveness piece, at whatever level we can do federally, is going to be part of the solution to get past this moment in this pandemic to provide relief and stimulus and new opportunities for more people.
Allison Schrager, do you have a feel for root cause problems, that there's a systemic reliance on debt to fund our higher education system in the United States, or that maybe our impression of the higher education as the only go-to is misguided?
I think it's all of that. I mean, as your caller points out, students get a message that this is the only way for upward mobility, and often it is, but not for everyone. And the real problem is a lot of those students go to college, realize it's not for them, and drop out when they would have been better off. I think as well, I mean, it sort of becomes, a bit of a vicious cycle of, you know, it's so easy to take out debt. So that sort of ends up driving the price, because students aren't very price sensitive. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there are advantages to that. I went to college in the UK, and for a lot of years it was free, but that worked great when a very small elite group of students went to college. But once they wanted to make college more accessible to everyone, they realized the government couldn't subsidize everyone. So also students there started taking out more loans. And in fact, I actually went to college in Scotland. They made a point of keeping college free for Scottish students, but not for English students. And it turned out Scottish students actually ended up taking out more debt than the English students, because they had no way of paying for living expenses. As opposed to, there are advantages of our system that does provide financial aid for some needy students. The problem is we don't have enough education, we don't have enough resources or access to education on financial aid.
Martha, thanks for that call. I guess, you know, this is an ongoing issue that we won't solve today. But Allison Schrager, just short term, what would you like to see the Biden administration do when it kicks off in mid-January?
I'd like to see them reform the income-based repayment program, increase awareness on it, and reform it so it's easier and more accessible. So the students who are really struggling can find ways to manage paying their debts, but not have it completely overwhelm their lives.
And Pete Van Leer, what about you?
Well, I would just, the income-based piece is really good. I think another thing Ohio could do is to look into a student loan borrower bill of rights. A dozen of states or so have passed these that they set clear standards, they ban some of the abuses, regulation of for-profits, and they require transparency. And so there's a lot of things that's another thing that could happen at the state level in the short term.
Pete Van Leer, research consultant with Policy Matters Ohio. Really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ann.
And Allison Schrager, senior fellow at Manhattan Institute. Thanks for your time as well. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's it for now. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.